So the topic is kosher fundraising, the ethics of a nonprofit ask. I hope that everyone got the source sheet that I sent out in advance on the email list. I'm going to post it in the chat now as well, so hopefully people who were not on it, who were not on the email list before will still be able to get it. So that's just going to take a moment while I connect everything here for it to upload. But what I want to do, as I find it on the computer. Here we go, and it's uploading. So, or at least I think it is. Inevitably, a glitch. Let's try that again. Okay, this time it went. So those who did not get it in advance should be able to download it now. But what I would like to do here is to talk about three different aspects of fundraising, of running a CRA-recognized charity. So I gave you vignettes at the top of the source sheet. You can see them there. And to the extent possible, I'm going to try to avoid doing the sharing of the screen so that I can actually see you and we can interact more, which would be good. So I'm going to avoid sharing the screen. But again, the three vignettes that you have on the source sheet, I will read them out, and hopefully that will help. All the organizations, all the charities that I am mentioning here in these three vignettes are based on a document called Anything Goes, Approval of Nonprofit Status by the IRS, published in 2009 by the Stanford University Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society. All of these are very close to the real names of organizations that were approved as nonprofits in 2008. By the IRS. I'm not discussing in this session the difference between a charity and a nonprofit. It's interesting, but not where we're going. But here are vignettes. Janet is eating dinner with her family when the Manitoba Magnolia Cloggers, a registered charity devoted to teaching the clogging form of dance, calls to solicit funds to support their work. Janet instructs the caller to desist from calling her in the future. May the cloggers call Janet in 3 years. That's question number one. And yes, the Manitoba Magnolia Cloggers almost exist. They're the Mississippi or Missouri Magnolia Cloggers. I think Mississippi Magnolia Cloggers. And that is indeed their mission, to teach clogging. So their question is obviously a do not call question. That's our first one. Second one. Let somebody in. Second one. Anthony volunteers as an accountant for the Medimperion Association, a registered charity dedicated to developing people's telepathic skills. And yes, that's a thing. May the organization provide a tax receipt for the time Anthony has devoted to assisting their work based on their cost savings in receiving pro bono financial services. Okay? Anthony is doing accounting for them. They don't need to pay him. Is he entitled to say, but I, the hours that I spent would have been $2,000 or whatever it was if I were doing it for pay? So I want a tax receipt for $2,000. That's our second question. And yes, the Medimperion Association is, I think it's the Medimperion Organization or something like that, but that's a thing. And then the third one, also a thing. The Red Nose Association, a registered charity which sends clown noses to troops overseas to lighten their mood, successfully solicits a donor in a campaign to fund their 2021 shipments of noses. However, a tree falls on their storage warehouse, damaging the roof. May the association reroute the funds to repair the roof without consulting the donor? Okay. Those are our those are the questions that I'd like us to address in the course of our session. So let me ask you, going back to the first one first, the Manitoba Magnolia Cloggers, Janet does not want them to call her again. She says, do not call me. Are they allowed, from a Jewish perspective, from a secular perspective, are they allowed to call her in 3 years? What would you say?
Not like express specific request not to call. I would think they would not be allowed to call.
Mm-hmm. She asked specifically not to call. You think they would not be allowed to call. Are you saying that from a Jewish perspective or a Canadian law perspective?
I think even from Canadian law, it's do not call list has to be maintained.
Mm-hmm.
I would think, if anything, a Jewish perspective would even be stronger ethically, that even if there wasn't such a thing as a formal list, if someone makes a request not to trouble them or bother them, then perhaps that should stand.
Okay. Well, we shall see. Believe it or not, Canadian law is going to be a lot more clear. And in fact, opposed to recalling, although we'll see what the time frame is for that. Jewish law is not going to be quite so clear. But that's our first vignette. The second one, is Anthony able to get a tax receipt from the telepaths or would-be telepaths for the time spent doing accounting for their registered charity? What do you think? From a secular law perspective, Canadian law perspective.
I believe that's a no-no.
That is a no-no, says David. Why?
I think measurements of that would be subjective.
Mm. Measurement is pretty subjective. I mean, he could always tell them what his standard billing rate is, I suppose.
Can you hear me?
Yes, Steve, I hear you.
Okay, under Canadian law, you can only give a receipt for services.
Right. Cannot give a receipt for services. So David and Steve are in agreement. From a halachic perspective, from a Jewish law perspective, do you think that his hours count in some way towards tzedakah? Can he count that as a donation for tzedakah of the $2,000 he would normally have billed, I should say. Okay, that's a question.
I think that if he's a professional doing it, and he would normally charge that as his profession, then yeah, it would be able to be counted towards tzedakah.
Perhaps. Perhaps indeed. And Eldon notes something which we're going to come back to in the chat about the possibility of him getting paid and then paying back his fees. That's on the secular side as a donation. But what Eddie says in terms of tzedakah, we're going to discuss. There's a little nuance that you have to consider in this regard, but we'll come back to that. And then the third case, the Red Nose Association. They raised funds to send the noses in 2021 overseas. I wrote them a check. I thought that was a wonderful cause. And then they decide they'd like to use it instead to repair the roof of the warehouse where they're storing the clown noses. So are they able to decide to use the funds to repair the roof instead of the clown noses? What would you say from a secular law perspective? Okay, we're going to have to talk about that, rerouting. And we're going to have to talk about it from a Jewish law perspective, where it's also fascinating. I noted the question that was there in the chat from Sheldon. Doesn't volunteer work have the value of a watchman's wages? And the answer is not necessarily. But we're going to talk that through. As a general principle, I see people putting comments in the chat. It actually works better for me when I'm giving a shiur if someone unmutes themselves and asks the question, as opposed to putting it in the chat. Otherwise, I end up watching people's faces, watching the chat. It's harder for me. So I actually prefer it if people ask the question directly, and then I can either address it now or, you know, defer till later. So on the other hand, I will repeat, since a few people have signed on since I started, I want to make sure that people sign in, both to join the email list and to get a credit letter after the series is over. So if you're on here and your name is visible and you're on our email list already, you don't need to do anything. We've got your name, we've got your email list, email address. On the other hand, in the event, that either your full name is not showing or you're not on the email list, please make sure to just send a little message to me in the chat. It doesn't have to be to everybody, with name and email address, and that way you'll be able to get your credit letter, and that way you will also be able to find out about further business ethics sessions. Okay, so yes.
I mean, well, first of all, one quick note for people if they don't know, it's very easy to mute and unmute with this place in the space bar.
Yes.
So you can just come in and then mute back again.
Yeah.
I guess the only other thing I wanted to ask was, does it matter how the funds were donated? Were they donated with specific instructions? disruption, or were they made in a general way?
Absolutely. And that's why I framed it the way I did, by putting it as being there was a response to a fundraising campaign. We're going to talk about those nuances as we go through it. Absolutely. So let's go back to the first one. The issue that we started with is the person who gets a phone call during dinner and says, "Do not call me again." What is the nature of that? And in order to address that, we have to take a step back with a major preface which will affect everything we discuss, which is, how does general society look at charitable fundraising? And how does Jewish law look at charitable fundraising? So general society really values fundraising work on behalf of charities. This is most visible in the fact that there are tax exemptions of various kinds and to various degrees for the charities themselves. Why is it that society values charitable fundraising? What's the benefit to society? Why is it that it's important? Why are there tax exemptions?
Allows individuals to fund things that are valuable to society without the government having to do that directly, and people can make their own specific choices as to what's valuable to them.
Mm-hmm. So one way to look at it, I'm going to grab from the middle of your comment, is that ultimately this is going to benefit society when it receives these services that the charity is providing, and it has the benefit of allowing the individual to be the one to make that call. But I think from a society perspective, the main point is government doesn't need to provide the service because the charity is going to take care of it. Instead of government needing to improve the mood of soldiers overseas, now we have the Red Nose Association, and they are sending clown noses. And therefore, the government doesn't need to fund that and doesn't need to worry about it. We're covered because we've got clown noses. That's one way to look at it. What other explanation could there be for why government is in favor of charities such that they're going to provide tax exemptions? There are a couple of other explanations, even before we get to the cynical explanation.
So, it's altruistic. It's a good thing to do. You want to sort of foster altruism in people.
Government does not provide tax exemptions for altruism. As a general principle, government views itself as the ultimate altruist, and therefore attempts to take money away from what they're doing are never going to out-altruist the government. As far as they're concerned, we need your money in order to provide highways and hospitals and all these other things. What do you mean you're an altruist? We're altruists. That's just the philosophy of government. So I found a great paper. I found a few great papers by a woman by the name of Evelyn Brody. And one in particular that I gave you a brief quote from is called "Of Sovereignty and Subsidy, Conceptualizing the Charity Tax Exemption." So it's the first source on your source sheet, in which she writes the following. "Why are charities tax exempt? This question has been discussed in general theoretical terms of whether the exemption is, on the one hand, a subsidy, or on the other, an acknowledgement that charitable activity falls outside the right tax base." I just posted this source sheet again in the chat for those who joined after I posted it before. So please take advantage of the opportunity to download that if you don't have it. But she mentions two things. One point that she mentions is the subsidy, which is what we've already said. The government would like to subsidize other people to do the work that way the government will not need to do. And that's one way to look at it. But there's another way that she mentions that you can look at it, which is that charitable activity falls outside the, quote, right tax base. I'm noticing that a lot of faces have frozen. Is that because everybody's reading? Or is that because we're having a connection problem? Can you hear me? Okay, you can hear me. Okay, so as long as you can hear me, I guess we're okay. I've done everything I can to get rid of other processes on the computer, so hopefully this is still working. The other approach that she's giving here is that government doesn't have the right to tax charitable endeavors. whether they're religious or otherwise. Doesn't make a difference. Government doesn't have control of this kind of financial activity. That's the other idea that that she mentions here. So you could look at it the way we said, which is that it's a subsidy, but you could also look at it as a statement of we don't have the right to that money. And then in a footnote, she adds a third perspective, yet a third theory, one of administrative convenience. And what she means by administrative convenience, I believe, is that the government would like to encourage the formation of responsible organizations to do charitable work efficiently. So therefore, if you create a charity that is going to do the work of distributing funds to people who are in need, or is going to create hospitals or fill in the blank, all the different things that these charities are supposed to be doing, the government says, that's really good. We want to reward that. We want to encourage that, which is why government will say, we're not going to give a receipt if you just donate money to an individual. When you give money to a specific person, that doesn't cut it. However, if your organization is doing work, that's something that we want to subsidize. So three different approaches to why government wants to support this. There's also the cynical approach, which is lobbyists. It has nothing to do with wanting to support charitable work, but rather it has to do with the fact that there are people who say, if you will give us a tax exemption, we will get you votes. So that's a whole other political basis for this approach. But taking the argument that charities provide services that otherwise government would need to provide, or taking the argument that government wants to encourage the formation of responsible organizations to do charitable work, they are promoting fundraising because it benefits society as a whole, and particularly if it's done well. That's the idea. However, Judaism sees benefits that are practical and religious. And while we don't have a concept of a tax exemption for it in Judaism, meaning if someone works for an organization that is a registered charity, they don't get to say, I don't need to pay tzedakah, I don't need to give tzedakah out of my income that I earn from doing fundraising. That's not a thing within Judaism. You don't get to make that statement. Nonetheless, we do have statements about the great stature of fundraising in Judaism and the reward for it. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 2, passage in the Talmud, Bava Basra. Amar Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar says, Gadol hama'asa yosem min ha'osa. I'm going to stick to my English translations that I've given you here on the sheet, but you have the Hebrew original as well. He says, it is greater to cause others to act than to act oneself regarding tzedakah. It's better for you to get other people to give tzedakah than to give it yourself. And he quotes you a verse for it, and this is actually brought as halacha in the Shulchan Aruch, in the code of Jewish law. That's how great we consider doing this. Why is it so great to get others to give tzedakah? So Rabbi Menachem Meiri in 13th century France, he's in source number 3 on the sheet, says the mitzvah of tzedakah applies beyond having a personal obligation to give tzedakah. One is even obligated to cause others to give. He says, my core mitzvah of giving tzedakah is actually a duty to get others to give tzedakah. Beyond my responsibility to give it myself, I also have a responsibility to get others to give. So therefore, it's greater to get others to give than it is for me to give on my own. That's the Meiri's perspective. That's one approach. Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, writing in the beginning of the 20th century, offered a different approach. He says, you want to know why there's greater reward for getting others to give? Because it's harder. It's harder to get other people to give than to just write a check yourself. Yeah, it was very funny. When I was just starting out in the rabbinate, a rabbi from a different city commented to me that he was among the top donors to his benevolent fund, to his discretionary fund. And at the time I thought, oh, that's interesting. But then when I had my own discretionary fund that I was responsible for, I understood exactly what he meant. A cause comes up, something comes to hand, and you have a choice. Either find a way to give this myself, or go ask somebody to give. Guess which one you're going to choose? It's much easier to see if you have any stock of funds available, and so the rabbi ends up being the one of the top benefactors of the discretionary fund.
All right, I certainly remember when our kids had to do collecting for school projects or whatever. I think we ended up just doing the whole thing ourselves rather than have to go around and ask friends,
right,
or work and ask.
Right.
Just easy to do.
Right. So you have completely defeated the educational value of having your children do that. But at the same time, it's hard to get people to give money. It's not a simple thing. When I lived in Pennsylvania, I used to volunteer for the telethons for UJA there, and I used to ask for the zero cards, the ones who have given nothing in the past, because that way there's only one way to go, and that's up. And if I can get them to give anything, they have increased an infinite percent over where they were before. And if not, well, okay, back to the drawing board. So look at Rabbi Epstein's comment in source number 4. He says, there is no harder labor in the sanctuary. He's borrowing a term from the Talmud there. There is no harder labor in the sanctuary than gathering tzedakah from others. Therefore, its reward is great. So Judaism values the act of fundraising, and part of that, again, is practical. Right? One reason why we value fundraising is simply a practical point. If you take a look at source number 5, a passage from the Talmud in which one of the sages says, we owe a great debt to the Ramaim, to people who are tricksters, people who are dishonest, people who get us to look at them and give to them. Even though they don't deserve it, we owe them a big thank you. Because if not for them, we would not notice the real people, the people who are authentically in need. So therefore, we are grateful to those who are not telling the truth, because at least they'll get us to pay attention to others. In other words, there is value to, that's not really true. You shouldn't go be, don't take this as a mandate now. Let me go be dishonest and try to attract people's attention to the needs of others. But the statement is, you need people to draw attention to those who are in need. And that's one benefit. But there's also an added component, which is fundraising has a religious benefit to it. Tzedakah is a mitzvah, and you as a fundraiser are enabling others to do a mitzvah. And we have a principle, which I brought you in source number 6, called Hamizake es Harabim. If somebody brings merit to other people, as the Gemara there, the Talmud there says, sin will never come about to his deeds, due to his deeds. It's a wonderful thing to enable others to do mitzvot. So therefore, even as general society says there is a practical benefit in having these charitable organizations, and therefore we will reward them with tax exemptions, Judaism doesn't offer a tax exemption, a tzedakah exemption, but it does say there is great value to their work, both on a practical level, they make sure that needs will be filled, they're helping the recipient, but also because they're performing a mitzvah themselves, and they are enabling others to perform mitzvot, so therefore their work is valuable. Based on that, I might have assumed that there should be no strings attached. If you're a fundraiser, if you're a tzedakah collector, you should be able to do whatever you want. Hang on one second. Okay, you can hear me again?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, it happens from time to time. Going back again to what I was saying, I might have expected that since society places such high value on the act of giving of fundraising and collecting tzedakah, we should make it as easy as possible for people and put as few strings as we possibly can on their activity. At the same time, neither general society nor Judaism is willing to tolerate commercial harassment of its members. We don't like the idea that individuals can be harassed by somebody for commercial purposes. Not charitable now, but commercial purposes. So if you take a look at source number 7, Canada's anti-spam legislation, a constitutional analysis. the writers point out the various problems that come from, in their case, online solicitations and spam. This is not just about that. The principles apply beyond that. But they write, possessing and managing spam creates a number of burdens on individuals and businesses. For businesses that use electronic communications or utilize the internet to provide corporate and commercial services, the prevalence and growth of spam is recognized as a cost of doing business. You have to invest in dealing with it. Businesses, including internet network service providers, are forced to invest ever-increasing resources to prevent spam from entering their networks and negatively affecting their operations and credibility. This cost is paid for by the organizations and businesses themselves, and also through service charges paid by personal internet users. For individuals, the costs associated with purchasing and installing additional programs to manage, filter, and protect against such electronic threats is a cost of online participation. So there is a financial cost involved, and there's a work cost involved in dealing with this kind of invasion. And in addition to imposing cost burdens, the negative effects of spam can lead to reduced confidence levels in the eyes of end users regarding the safety and security of the internet. The bottom line is, society does not want to have not only spam, but does not want people to have to deal with spending money and spending time getting rid of unwanted commercial solicitations. So to apply this to the financial services sector, if you take a look at source number 8, we get guidance from CPA Ontario, in which we are told, a member or firm shall not, either directly or indirectly, solicit in a manner that is persistent, coercive, or harassing, any professional engagement. This is not the nonprofit discussion. This is a general discussion. This is separate from the discussion of nonprofits. We're saying that a financial services professional is not allowed to solicit business from somebody if that is persistent, coercive, or harassing. And it continues in the guidance, and still in source number 8, to say, communication with a prospective client should cease when the prospect so requests, either directly to the member or firm or through CPA Ontario. Any continued contact will be regarded as harassment, which is contrary to the rule. Clear? Yeah, you follow what we're saying here. The harassment is a no-no. Practical application for financial services professionals, and practical application as well in terms of what a charity is able to do. We're going to come back to that. But now I want to shift gears and talk about it from a Jewish perspective. Yes, Miriam.
Is it persistent? Because that's sort of like not a very clear term. If someone says, don't do it ever again, that even going more than once becomes persistent and harassing.
Right. So I think if the other person has said to you, I don't want it, then automatically it's now harassing if not persistent. It may not qualify as persistent, but it certainly qualifies as harassing. They have told you we don't want to be contacted. Yeah. By the way, for those who signed on in the last few minutes, I have again posted the source sheet in the chat. For anyone who doesn't have it, you should be able to download it from there. So that's from a general...
But twice in three years, you would consider that harassment.
So, did the person say no?
3 years ago.
The person said, don't contact me again. Did they say, don't contact me in 3 years?
3 years ago.
So I'm going to come back to how long you actually have to keep them on the list. We're not quite there yet. But we will be at number 12, so hang in there. From a Jewish perspective, how does this work? So from a Jewish perspective, just like in general society, we have concerns about harming the person who is on the receiving end. Under this broad principle that is called in Hebrew, ona'at divarim, also known in English as verbal abuse. I brought you examples of verbal abuse from the Talmud in source number 9, but in the interest of time, I'm not going to actually read it aloud. But we are taught that there is a biblical prohibition against using your speech in order to make others feel bad. And that would include where they said, I don't want you contacting me. That would seem to be included. That's number one. Number two, just like we said, fundraising is good for the spirituality of the fundraiser, doing it in a way that is harassing is actually negative in terms of the spirituality of the fundraiser. We have a law in the Torah called Lo Sach Mod, that you are not allowed to covet the financial resources of other people. That is actually prohibited. And that plays out in the Code of Jewish Law in source number 10. Rabbi Yosef Karo, author of the Code of Jewish Law, says, "One who desires another person's servant, maid, home, or implement, or anything he can purchase from him, and who weighs him down with third parties and badgers him until he can buy it, you get other people to ask the person, and you keep asking the person, you violate the prohibition of lo tachmod, you shall not desire." And if you look at source number 11, Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau, who was a very important judge in Israeli courts until he passed away about 5 years ago, says, "I have seen one who wrote that the same applies for one who pushes another person to buy from him. This involves the prohibition against what's called chamas in biblical Hebrew." And he says, "I agree." His words appear to be correct. You are not allowed to push other people commercially to be an aggressive seller or an aggressive buyer for something that the person doesn't want to sell you. So, we have now established two poles. On the one hand, general society and Jewish law favor fundraising activity for charitable purposes. We like it. General society says this is good for society, the government shouldn't be taxing it, and so on. Jewish law says this is good because you make sure people who need money will get it, and it's good for the spirituality of the person who is soliciting and the person who is the donor. Go for it. At the same time, general society says we don't want people harassing other people to get their money. That's a bad thing. Jewish law says we don't want you to use your speech against others in ways that are painful to them, and we don't want you, again, to push and to harass in order to get other people's funds. So how does this play out in terms of the do not call list? What do you do with these two poles? So the answer seems to be that when it comes to general society, they look at it and say, charitable giving and charitable fundraising is important for the benefit of society, but the right to seclusion, the right to privacy, is also a need of society, and therefore you are not allowed to fundraise at the expense of somebody's privacy. If you take a look at source number 12, John, now we are back at source number 12. From the Canadian Radio, Television, and Telecommunications Commission Unsolicited Telecommunications Rules. That is a name needing an acronym. Okay. Rule number 8 of the telemarketing rules. A telemarketer initiating a telemarketing telecommunication on its own behalf shall maintain its own do not call list and shall keep a consumer's name and telecommunications number on the list for a period of 3 years and 14 days from the date of the consumer's do not call request. 3 years and 14 days. That's really specific. Where did you get your 14 days from? So I imagine it's because of what's coming next. Each rule, set of two rules here are really the same rule, just repeated. One is where the telemarketer is operating for her own organization, and the other is where the telemarketer is operating for another organization. So 8 and 9 are the same rule. Fundamentally, telemarketer and client of a telemarketer. Take a look at rule number 10. A telemarketer initiating a voice telemarketing telecommunication shall process a do not call request from a consumer at the time of the telemarketing communication. At that time, you have to process the request. But how much time do you have? So look at the next rule. A telemarketer initiating a telemarketing telecommunication on its own behalf shall add a consumer's name and telecommunications number to its do not call list within 14 days of the consumer's do not call request. So that's why it's 3 years and 14 days. 14 days to add it to the list, and then 3 years from then. And then it goes on further. You can read it. You have to ensure that the client actually adds the name if you have a client involved, and you're not allowed to call anybody who is on this internally held list. That's a general society perspective. And so to go back to our vignette, the cloggers will not be allowed to make that phone call. That's the upshot. The cloggers are not allowed to call Janet back within 3 years. That's from a general perspective.
They can't hook up the phone lines, can they?
and they can't clog up the phone lines. No, and we really needed you to say that. We needed a clogging joke. So thank you. I am very appreciative. Yes, Chaim.
With regards to the source 1011,
yeah.
Well, seemingly wouldn't apply if you're a fundraiser if you have a third-party.
So now, right, Chaim provides me with the next step, which is, what about the Jewish law perspective? How is Judaism going to look at it? Will we apply the rules about general commercial harassment to tzedakah? And the answer is, mostly not. There are very few restrictions in Judaism on asking people for tzedakah, and the reason for that, I think, is because it's of religious value, as opposed to just being of practical value. It's because it's a religious endeavor, that religious concern overrides the statement of, I don't want people to harass me. Which makes sense, because really, I already know people don't want to give. That's not a novelty. You didn't teach me anything I didn't know. What I need to do, though, is still to be able to solicit funds. So, because of that, because of that point, there are few restrictions. However, there are some restrictions. It's not that there are none. There is protection from unwanted solicitation for people who don't know how to say no. In source number 13, I gave you the story of a sage by the name of Elazar of Birata. When the tzedakah collectors saw him, they would hide, because he used to give them whatever he had with him. And they knew that it was wrong for them to take everything he had. This is actually codified in source number 14. The passage from the Talmud Bava Batra, that discussion in Bava Batra in source number 14, is the major source in the Talmud for discussions about tzedakah collection. Rav Nachman quoted Rabba Bar Avua to say that we take security, he's in the middle of a discussion that it's sort of jumping into. He says, we take security for tzedakah even on a Friday. In other words, if somebody is supposed to give tzedakah and they're not giving it, we will invade their property and take their stuff and hold it until they give tzedakah. And even if it's Friday, they're running around trying to get ready for Shabbos. I don't care. We're going to go in and take collateral for this tzedakah. To which the Talmud asks, but there's a verse in Jeremiah in which God says, I am going to punish all those who oppress people. And the Talmud quotes Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Shmuel Bar Marta quoting Rav to say, even tzedakah collectors, you're not allowed to oppress people. To which the Talmud answers, yeah, that's okay. That doesn't bother me. Why? Because if the guy has the means to give, then you are not considered to be oppressing him. It's only if the person lacks the means to give that you are considered to be oppressing him. So where you have somebody who is vulnerable, somebody who doesn't know how to say no, then you're not allowed to go after him. However, otherwise, you're allowed to keep on asking, and even if he says, don't call me again, from a Jewish law perspective, keep on calling. Let me be clear. The Jewish organization is going to have to honor, hang on, Miriam, is going to have to honor Dina de Malchuta, the law of the land. If the government says no calling, the organization is not going to be allowed to call. But from a purely Jewish perspective, they can keep right on asking if the person has the means and the ability to give. Obviously, you have to know how to evaluate that. But that's the idea. Miriam.
That was my question.
Yes.
The Dina de Malchuta, okay.
Yes.
Could you say that part of why this is allowed is ultimately it's for the benefit of the person to give tzedakah?
Yeah.
So you're doing what their soul wants to do, like giving again, things like that. Like, I mean, it's good for them to do it.
Right. It is absolutely part of it. That plus the level of need in general. We have rules to protect the extra vulnerable, but that's it. And the idea is, it's not onad devarim, it's not verbal abuse. You're not bringing your strength to harm the person. This is a person's religious responsibility. And it's not lo tachmod. You're not trying to get their money for yourself. You're trying to get it in order to be, in order to take care of those in need. I'm not sure what happens if you're a fundraiser and your sole concern is just getting paid. You're not really raising the funds for the sake of the needy people. You're raising it for yourself. I'm not sure how that would work. But if you take a look at Maimonides in source number 15, the Rambam, he says, one who does not wish to give tzedakah or who gives less than is appropriate for him, the court compels him to give. That's the rabbinical court's job, the Beit Din. An overly giving person who gives more tzedakah than is appropriate for him, or who pains himself and gives to the collectors to avoid shame, one may not claim from him and collect tzedakah from him, and a collector who shames him and asks from him will be punished, quoting the verse from before. So if you know the person is giving more than they should be, is being shamed into giving, then you can't go after him. Okay.
It's not because the mishloach comes to your door for his own individual needs. You can tell, don't come to me anymore, because he's coming for himself, not for an organization.
No, why would that, you mean under the Lo Tachmod point? No,
yes.
I think not, because the fact that it's still your mitzvah applies. I hear you in terms of Lo Tachmod, but I think not, because it's still your mitzvah. That would be my gut. Okay.
When you say you have an obligation to give tzedakah, you don't have an obligation to give tzedakah to any particular tzedakah, right? Like it's you have an obligation to give a certain percentage to tzedakah, but no one tzedakah can say to you, you have an obligation to me, right?
Correct. That is correct. The duty is to give, not necessarily to them.
Most the response can always be, but I've given to, in theory,
yeah.
But I've given to someone else.
Right.
Give my share also to someone else. Don't persist.
Correct. And it's the responsibility of who's doing the evaluation, which is usually supposed to be the city's, municipal court, to take all of that into consideration. This isn't something you see people be able to evaluate today. That doesn't work. Moshe, you had a question.
Yeah. What about telling the drivers, that driver on the Mishloach Mod, that pointing out the question before, and say, hey, I don't want you coming to my house without the Mishloach.
Right. So, again, if he is somebody who is raising funds for tzedakah by bringing them around, then I don't think you're actually able to stop him from doing so under this. I think this doesn't, the question is, do you view him as raising funds for them by the fact that he drives them around? And that I'm not so sure of. That's my hesitation. I want to move further, but I also want to again reiterate, because people keep on joining, if your name is not showing, or if your name is showing and I have your email address, you're on the email list, then you'll get your credit certificate, you'll keep getting emails. However, if your full name isn't showing or you're not on the email list, please send that information to me to ensure that you get your credit letter, as well as to ensure that you get notification of next sessions like the one next week. Moving to the second vignette, our question was, and this is quicker, this one, our question was, the accountant who does work for a charity, is she able to say, I want a credit receipt for the time that I provided? Those are billable hours. I could have billed $2,000. I'd like a $2,000 receipt. So we've already said that secular sources, secular law, and Jewish law support the work of these charities and want you, in fact, to help them out. However, secular law says no. You are not able to receipt it for taxes, as we noted in the beginning. I think David said it, and Eldon said it. Was it Eldon? Somebody said it also. David and someone else. Steve. Steve said it. Source number 16 from the Government of Canada's website. A charity cannot issue a receipt for a gift or service. At law, a gift is a voluntary transfer of property without consideration. Contributions of services, for example, time, skills, effort, are not property. Therefore, they do not qualify as gifts for the purpose of issuing official donation receipts. What may be done, and this was what Eldon had written in the chat at the time, is the charity can pay the person $2,000 for that service, and then, properly documenting that they've done so, and then the accountant can donate it back. That works. And the reasons given for why a charity can't do this just to give a receipt is largely that it's very hard to calculate. time is not taxed as one answer is because it's hard to calculate. The other explanation I've seen is that time is not taxed as property. You're not taxing people's time, so therefore you can't say time is currency in terms of constituting a donation. That's the other philosophy behind it. Within Judaism, you are able, in fact, to count your donation, so to speak. Why? Because in Judaism, your time is taxed. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, in source number 17, addressing a yeshiva student who was talking about learning with other people, says that the yeshiva student should use 10% of the time that he has available to learn Torah to learn with other people, to teach them. And that constitutes a meiser. That constitutes tithing his time. So based on that, you can say, my time is actually worth something. So much so, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said that if you exceed the 10% of your time threshold, if the time that you spend in helping others, learning with others, doing the accounting work for the organization, whatever it is, if the time that you spend is beyond 10%, you are able to value it as a financial contribution to tzedakah based on what you would have been paid for that time minus the 10% that you would have needed to donate from the funds that you would have been paid. So to make that more clear, look at source number 18. This is from Rabbi Dr. Cyril Dom, the book Maaser Ksavim, which is a very, very, very good resource. I highly recommend it. If a professionally qualified person furnishes his services gratuitously to a Torah institution or for a poor person, can he deduct his fee from Maaser? Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says this is legitimate, provided he remembers to include the fee in his Maaser accounting. In other words, if I am going to account it as though I had given them $2,000, that means that my income for the year includes that $2,000. When I calculate my income that I have to give 10% of to tzedakah, I have to count that $2,000 as income. If he has no overhead expenses, he may deduct 9/10 of his professional fee, not the full amount, because again, 1/10 of it is supposed to be donated back. That's the way it works. It's not $2,000, it's $1,800. $200 of it you owed to tzedakah, and the other $1,800 you can say, that's my donation. Moshe.
Why not just skip over the step? It's just a thing that a lot of charity organizations have done is that they do they call it a check swap. So they invoice so the accountant or whoever will invoice the charity for $2,000. Charity will pay the invoice and then the accountant will write a check back to the charity as a $2,000 donation.
Right. No, right, that's what we had mentioned in the secular part. That they'll pay, and then you just donate it back. But you have to make sure that you document it well. If you don't document it well, you will end up in trouble. Yes, Miriam. I'm sorry, you're...
18 talks about donating to a Torah institution. Source 18 talks about donating to a Torah institution or to a poor person. What if it was neither? What if it was like to the Canadian Cancer Society? Is it really specific that it only has to be door institutions and poor people? There's so many other charitable causes that are legitimate.
Right. So that's why I tried to give it the inflection that I did when I was reading it. These are examples. This is not the sum of all stock organizations. I said in the very beginning, I don't want to get into a discussion of what exactly qualifies as a charity in Jewish law versus the secular law and charities versus nonprofits, because as interesting as that discussion is, it's beyond the scope of where we are right now. So that I'm not going to get addressed right now. But no, this is not an exhaustive list. Our last vignette was the clown noses case. And we only have a few minutes, so I want to make sure to get through all of it. One more plug. Please make sure to send me your email address if you're not on the list, and especially if you want to get a credit letter, unless your name is showing on the screen and your email address is already known to us. Thank you. So again, our case that we're now talking about is the case of the clown noses. The clown company or whatever they are, not the clone company, the organization, sorry, I'm trying to do too many things at once. The organization that is sending clown noses overseas to the military to boost their spirits raises funds specifically for that purpose. However, they then need it to repair the roof on the warehouse where they store the clown noses. Are they allowed to reroute the funds? So I'm going to do this really briefly to fit it into the time frame, and we'll come back to it, God willing, on some other occasion to deal with it in depth. In the secular system, there is strong honor for donor intent where it has been expressed. There is such a thing as unrestricted donations. Those exist. And then there are special purpose charitable trusts where you say, I am giving the funds for a particular purpose, and you can't use it then for other purposes. That includes endowment funds, donor restricted use funds, restricted charitable trust property, all of these things. How do you establish what somebody's purpose is? So what you need is certainty of intention. You have to know that they were trying to donate it for this particular use. If you're following along the sheet, you want sources 19, 20, 21, that whole discussion that I gave you there, which I'm now broadly skipping in the interests of time. But the but one thing that we stipulate is that giving to, in source number 21, the last line, giving to a public fundraising campaign constitutes a special purpose charitable trust, and therefore it has to be used for that purpose. So if you were solicited for clown noses, then that's where you have to give it. That's where they have to use it. And if you take a look at source number 22, you find in the Charities Accounting Act that in the event that you sue them for violating your donor intent, they can get into serious trouble. They may need to pay the court funds. They may need to replace the person administering the charity. All sorts of problems for them in the event that they don't do what they said they were going to do. What about in a Jewish law perspective? So Jewish law is more flexible in this regard. Here there is an insistence on honoring donor intent as well. There are two schools of thought. One school of thought is that if I give to you and I want it to be used for X, then my gift is actually conditional. And if you don't use it for X, you violated what I said, and therefore the gift never happened. It was, I'm giving this to you on condition that you use it in this way. The other school of thought is that the donor has reserved the rights and said, I am giving this money to you in the sense that I'm giving you the right to use it for clown noses, but I reserve the rights of using it for any other purpose, and therefore it's theft if you use it in some unapproved way. The difference between those two approaches is that in the first approach, if you use it the wrong way, the gift actually reverses, because it was conditional. The second way, it would not reverse the gift. But what counts as donor intent in Jewish law? So that's a debate found in source number 23. And again, I'm just doing this very fast. I'm not going to go through the discussion. It'll come back, God willing, in a later session at some point. But the sum of it is that there's a debate between Rabbi Meir and the sages found in the Talmud. Rabbi Meir says even implied intent constitutes intent and must be honored, and you're a thief if you don't honor it. Whereas the sages disagree and say no. Only if there is an explicit intent. If I give you money and say this money is for Purim, for your Purim meal, that constitutes specific intent, but otherwise not. Why are the sages more tolerant of deviation from implied intent? I think probably because of the point that Rabbi Moshe Sofer makes, the Chasam Sofer, in source number 25, which is, if I give somebody money that I wanted him to use for one charitable purpose, and he used it for a different one, at the end of the day, I did my mitzvah, and therefore my claim on the use of the funds is over. I did my mitzvah. That's what I was supposed to do. I don't have to worry about what he chooses to do with it in terms of the mitzvah. That's the idea. And therefore, unless I have a specific statement of you must use it in this way, it's not called a violation of donor intent. How far do I have to go to stipulate it? So Rabbi Yair Bachrach in Germany in the 17th century, in source number 26, says, if the recipient said, I am raising funds to buy this for this purpose, that's not called donor intent. The fundraising campaign doesn't do it. But if the donor says, I am giving this to you to buy X, then indeed that counts as a stipulation, and they're not entitled to use it for some other purpose. So if I, you know, if I go to shul, and I say to the shul, listen, I am writing you a check for you to use for youth programs, they're not allowed to now donate it and use it for something else. However, if the shul says, we're raising money through this event for youth, and I just write a check, then they're able to reroute it and use it. And as, you know, look, you got your mitzvah, that was it. I hope this was helpful. I know I rushed to the ending. I'm going to stay on to deal with questions, but I gave you review questions at the end of the source sheet, and hopefully that will help as well. And again, I do hope to be able to revisit this last issue of the directed funds with a little bit more time at a later date. Again, please sign in, send me an email with your email address, or just put it in a message to me in the chat, is to join our email list or to get a credit letter. Thank you so much for participating. And now, if anyone has any questions, I will stay on.
Shkoyach to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, John. Yeah.
By me giving a pauper, maybe part of my tzedakah money I'm giving will go to tzedakah anyway, further on, meaning the, so, since I wonder what purpose